Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Judicial Campaign Solicitations Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On January 20th, 2015, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Williams v. Lee v. the Florida Bar. This case asks whether a rule of judicial conduct that prohibits candidates for judicial office from personally soliciting campaign funds violates the First Amendment. To discuss the case, we have Ed Whalen, who is the president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and Eric Jaffe, who is a sole practitioner at Eric S. Jaffe, PC. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Jaffe.
Thank you to the Federalist Society for, you know, making this opportunity available to chat with folks about this case. I think what I'll start with is we'll give a little background of the case for those who just want a quick refresher. So the issue in the case, Williams Uli versus the Florida Bar, was this particular rule that is a bar rule present in a number of states and based on an ABA model rule that forbids candidates for judicial office from personally soliciting campaign contributions. So to understand what that means is that in many states, candidates for judicial offices, judgeships, are filled by election. And in those elections, judges are allowed to speak to explain why they think they should be elected, or potential judges, candidates for judges. They're allowed to raise money. They're allowed to receive contributions, sometimes limited, sometimes not, sometimes whatever. All of those things are permissible. This rule says that in those states that have adopted it, that judges may not personally ask for that money. What they may do is set up a committee of close confidants, friends, or others who can ask for the money on their behalf. So if I were running for a judgeship, I would, you know, pick my four best friends and say, would you be my committee, and go around and ask people to contribute to my campaign fund so that I could get my message out. I can go personally tell you what I think. I can tell you what kind of judge I'm going to be. I can tell you whether I'm a strict constructionist. I just can't say, therefore, I'd really appreciate it if you gave a donation to my campaign. What I could do is say, therefore, I'd like you to talk to my friend Bob, and he'll ask you for money. That's what the whole fight is about, is that line between asking for it yourself and having your friend Bob, who's on your campaign committee, ask on your behalf. In this case, the particular candidate, Ms. Williams Uli, sent a letter, a mass mailing to a bunch of people that said, you know, by the way, I'm running. It'd be really helpful if I had a campaign fund, and would you please contribute? She sent this out to a bunch of folks and then posted it on her website and signed the letter herself. And her signature makes that a personal solicitation. Had it been signed by her campaign committee chairman, it would have been fine. She signed it herself, and that's what the fight's about. The Florida Supreme Court, after, you know, everybody, eventually she lost at all levels. She was disciplined. The Florida Supreme Court upheld the discipline, and now it's up at the Supreme Court. And that was what today's argument's about, is whether or not that restriction violates her First Amendment rights. And that's really all there is to it, with the one proviso that you should understand two more facts about the background of this rule. One is that while she's not permitted to personally solicit funds from anyone, whether in person or by letter, she is permitted to know who gave money and is permitted to personally send them a thank you letter. And the second thing is that in certain types of elections, particularly called retention elections, the rule disappears. So if you're already a judge and you're seeking to be reelected as a judge, which is an unopposed election, but there are people out there saying we think you should not be reelected, then this rule goes away and you can personally solicit whatever you want. So those are just two interesting facts to be aware of that sort of bear on some of the argument that was had today. And I will start with just a quick reaction to today's arguments. My quick reaction was as follows, which is I believe the First Amendment will win this case. I think it will be a 5-4 or a 6-3 decision, though I suppose I could be surprised. And I believe on the bottom of that decision will be Justice Ginsburg, Justice Sotomayor, and Justice Kagan, with the possibility of Breyer joining them, but an equally strong possibility of Breyer coming to the top side, writing a concurrence that gives a instructional chart as to how, in the future, state bars could implement a rule that gets most of this done without getting all of it done. And I'll start there, and I think Ed and I will now just chat about it. So, Ed, what was your sort of big reaction to the argument today, or what were the most notable points that you took away from it?
Well, thanks, Eric. I was struck by how the justices that you've just identified as likely being on the downside of the result here seem to be arguing as much over whether there should be judicial elections in the first place as they were arguing over this restriction on judicial candidates. Justice Ginsburg in particular seemed to ask the same question three or four times, I think reprising her argument in the White case from, what was that, 2000 or 2001. She's insisting that there can be different rules for judicial candidates than there are for political candidates. No one really disagrees with that from what I can tell. Justice Scalia back in White said he wasn't saying what she said. The petitioner's attorney today agreed with her, though she tried to say he disagreed. But again, I think what you see is an effort on the part of Justice Ginsburg and others to fight the battle against state judicial elections through the vehicle of this particular restriction.
I think you're exactly right. In fact, it was so striking, her repeated questions, that I wrote it down as a quote. She said that judges are supposed to be above the political fray, was the exact word she used. And I find that bizarre in any state that elects their judges. If you really think they're supposed to be above the political fray, one would imagine you wouldn't elect them. And the fact that you do elect them suggests that at least some component of their job, if not all of it, at least some of it, has a political component, because why else are you making them accountable to the public, which obviously the public is not composed predominantly of lawyers. They generally have no idea whether you're making a good or bad legal decision, but they have values that they may want from their judges or not want in their judges. And so if the public has a valid say in the matter, presumably there's a political component to the judging that goes on in some state courts, or at least their state legislators think so.
Well, the flip side of this is the question, just what are the state interests that a restriction like this is advancing? And I think there are arguably three somewhat distinct interests, and it was a challenge at times in the argument to sort them out. One is the concern about so-called quid pro quo arrangements. Actually, this is broken into the reality of quid pro quo and the appearance of quid pro quo. This actually, I think, is intuitively the most appealing argument that the State Bar of Florida makes. It says, look, the particular context in which a judicial candidate is having a one-on-one meeting with someone is exactly the context that raises the concern about quid pro quos, or that makes the public think something like that is going on. Now, as Eric mentioned, the particular fact situation in this case has nothing to do with that context. But I think that's this quid pro quo is one concern. A second is the whole question of whether judges concern over judicial impartiality. Will judicial impartiality be destroyed by judges raising funds for their elections? And then the third, which the justices seem to talk about quite a bit, though I found a little odd, is the sort of anti-coercion concern, that somehow there's this independent concern against folks being coerced to give money to judicial candidates, and that lawyers especially will find it hard to say no, I guess, not only to judges but to non-judge candidates. So those are the three interests that were cited. And Justice Scalia raised a fourth, Eric. I wasn't quite sure what your take was on why he raised it, but he was talking about asking the question whether whether judicial dignity is an independent interest of its own, whether you don't want to have judges running around as mendicants seeking money from contributors. Did you have a take on whether he was just setting something up or whether he had some real concern over that interest?
I think that's an excellent question. So Justice Scalia definitely kept coming back to that point on why isn't this just a question of, judges don't do this. It's unseemly for judges to be going around with hat in hand. Let other people do it for them, but they shouldn't be doing it themselves. And I took that as a genuine concern. One would almost treat it as a sort of a historical concern that this is just not the role of judges. And so he's coming up with a, if you will, sort of like a historical exception to the First Amendment rule. He doesn't want to come up with a sort of a an exception to the principles, but just an exception that somehow is based on the unique role of a judge and the unique history of judging that will... It seems to me that he doesn't like the fact that judges go begging, but likewise doesn't want to trash First Amendment law to get there. And so this is a possible out, which lets him come up with a sort of a, this is the way we've always done it exception. So obviously the First Amendment, you know, it's a sui generis exception. That's what I took that to. And I will say that in all, you know, to the credit of the attorney for the Florida Bar, he was quite candid in saying, yes, I know that would make my side win if anyone agreed with it, but quite frankly, I can't imagine how something as amorphous as judicial dignity would outweigh the First Amendment. So, no, we're not relying on that. And I think that pretty much shut down that as a likely avenue for Scalia to go anywhere when the Florida Bar is explicitly abandoning it as an option. So, yes, I think in the right case, with the right support, Scalia could turn around and create some sort of artificial exception or historical exception just because it's so distasteful in his mind. But I don't see that happening in this case.
Yeah. Well, I guess I couldn't tell whether he was really serious about that or whether he's simply going to say, well, of course, when you have judicial elections, you're going to have people campaigning, and that's not, you know, may not be compatible with our understanding of the federal model of judicial dignity, but how can you do it otherwise? So I wasn't sure whether he meant that seriously or was just setting something up.
He may have just been giving himself a trial balloon, right? To just sort of feel it out in his own mouth and his own head. I think you're right. His strong inclination is to go the other way. Consequently, maybe he was just sort of testing out a sort of an intuitive reaction and seeing how it played when spoken out loud.
Eric, the Chief Justice struck me as the strongest vote for the First Amendment against the rule here. Was that your take as well?
That was definitely my take, and in fact, I have a reasonable amount of confidence that he's a good candidate for writing this decision. He seemed largely impatient with the Bar Council on this issue, and I think he's pretty solidly signaled that he doesn't think this rule makes any sense. What I thought was sort of interesting is that his comments made me think that he views this more as a continuation of campaign finance cases in general rather than anything dealing with the special case of judges. His sort of more generic hostility to this struck me to have a broader tone to it than some of the other discussions that were very specific to the role of judges and judging. I don't know if you had the same reaction.
I think I did. Let me go back, Eric, to develop some of the points you had made about how under-inclusive this bar is. That is, you pointed out that, okay, under this rule, a judicial candidate can't personally solicit campaign funds, but she can set up a committee that can solicit campaign funds for her. And as I think her lawyer pointed out very well, the committee can actually send a letter out that says, we're soliciting funds on behalf of this judge. She's going to know whether you, this judicial candidate, she's going to know whether you contributed or not. In fact, she's going to write you a thank you if you do contribute. And so the question was, you know, is there any real difference in terms of any of these interests that were mentioned before with this letter from the campaign committee? Obviously, it could be done orally as well, versus a letter from the judge. Just add as well, the rules permit the judicial candidate to ask people personally to volunteer time and effort. You know, please come, you know, drop leaflets for me, for example. They also permit the candidate to learn of independent expenditures made on her behalf. So it's, I think in terms of under-inclusiveness doctrine, it's very difficult to see just how this particular rule would survive unless you really attach an awful lot of importance to this quid pro quo concern that can arise in very intimate settings. Again, I emphasize, though, that Williams-Yulee's facts don't raise that, which raises the whole question of, will this case be decided broadly or narrowly?
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www. www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.